हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तमाविर्विशावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay. Page 5, chapter 87, canto 10. Srila Sridhar Swami elaborately analyzes this problem in terms of the traditional discipline of Sanskrit poetics. We should consider that words have three kinds of expressive capacities called shabdavritis. These are the different ways a word refers to its meaning, distinguished as mukhyavriti, lakshanavriti, and gaunavriti. The shabdavriti termed mukhya is the primary, literal meaning of the word. This is also known as abhidha, a word's denotation, or dictionary meaning. Mukhyavriti is further divided into two subcategories, namely ludhi and yoga. A primary meaning is called ludhi, when it is based on conventional usage, and yoga when it is derived from another word's meaning by regular etymological rules. Right, so then there's some connection with some other. So in the context is there. For example, the word go, cow, is an example of ludhi, since its relationship with its literal meaning is purely conventional. The denotation of word paka, or pachaka, chef, on the other hand, is a yogavriti. Though the word's derivation from the word pach, to cook, by addition of the agent suffix ka. Right? So means there's some relationship. Means he's a cook. He's a chef because he cooks. Right? Cow just means they produce milk. Does that make sense? Yeah, so it just means that there's a connection to some other word. So in Sanskrit, this will mean make more, have more meaning than in the various properties that we may be speaking ourselves.
Now, when you speak about dictionary, the word is connected.
Here they've used the term dictionary. We saw before, abhidha means that which is, it means the direct meaning, and it also means that which is applied. You know, so the whole point is the direct meaning is that which is that directly applicable. And the other means that it's applicable, but it's not directly applicable. You know, the example of the cowherds on the Ganga. So it's not applicable on the Ganga. It's applicable next to the Ganga. So that poetic. So it's applicable, but it has some other form that it takes. It's not direct, it's indirect. You know, just like, let's say, devotional, we chanting our japa, that's direct devotional service. But let's say engaging our money in Krishna's service, that's indirect. Right? So that would be that aspect. So then within that, then it's just saying that of the direct, then those that inherently the words mean that, you don't have some other meaning, you know, then, you know, it's based on its own root or something like that. But when you have the root and then you have to add to that, like go, then it has its own words. But you see chef, pachaka, means it's pak, and then you have to add ka to it.
Yes.
So it's the one who is cooking.
Yes.
Right? Otherwise, cooking's the root. Right, you know, but go, it's this cowness is the root. So you have just, it's just meaning there's two kinds. So both of, because otherwise one may, well, because this is there, that would be indirect. No, it's still the direct word. Does that make sense?
So then a particular word, like go is cow, and go is also the senses. So
go is also
senses.
The senses.
Yeah,
but you see the context of where it's being used.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It means we have to still apply those other rules also. Okay. There's a context. But the main point is this, the Abhida, it's that which is applied in Abhideya. Right? So that's the way it's there. While the Gona and Lakshana, then these are secondary meanings. Means they have to be connected to something, like the money has to be connected to something that's connected to Krishna. The chanting is directly Krishna. The deity worship is directly Krishna. Does that make sense? Yeah. Besides this mukhya vritti, or primary meaning, a word can also be used in a secondary metaphorical sense. This usage is called lakshana. The rule is that a word should not be understood metaphorically if its mukhya vritti makes sense in the given context. Right? So that would always be used. So if in the context you're in, it makes sense in its direct meaning, you would use that. You wouldn't say, no, it's an indirect, like this. That's what these other philosophies, that's what they do. Like that, yeah. Only after mukhya vritti fails to convey a word's meaning may lakshana vritti be justifiably presumed. So it's not that, no, but it's as we please, and no. It's that only if it can't be used, then you use it. Right, sir? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
The function of lakshana is technically explained in the Kavya Shastras as an extended reference, pointing to something in some way related to the object of the literal meaning. So it has some connection to, but it's not directly showing it. Right? Thus, the phrase Gangayam Goshaha literally means the cowherd village in the Ganges. Right? So the mukhya you can't use here. Right? But the idea is absurd. Right, unless you're that village in Mexico that lives on the water there, but otherwise, then yes. So here, Gangayam should rather be understood as its lakshana to mean on the bank of the Ganges. Because it comes out very nicely, poetically, like this, Gangayam Goshaha. Otherwise, you'd have to say, the Gosha on the bank of the, like this, of the Ganges, and it wouldn't come out quite as poetic. So generally you see is that this lakshana can be used very nicely in poetics. But it also can be used in explanation of things because it's just more direct or it's understood. Does that make sense? We use it a lot. Subtleties and other things like that uses a lot of this lakshana. But the idea is absurd. So here, Gangayam should rather be understood by its lakshana than mean on the bank of the Ganges. The bank being something related to the river, right? Because it says Gangayam, so the bank is related. So since the direct meaning of the village, on the Ganga, or in the Ganga, doesn't make sense. So that means there has to be something related to Ganga, so that means the bank, the village can be on the bank. So you have to take some steps to get to it. That's lakshana, that's the indirect. Right? Direct means it's right there. Indirect means you have to take some steps. Gauna vritti is a special kind of lakshana. Right? So it's still a lakshana, it's still an indirect. But it's unique enough it has its own name. Where the meaning is extended to some idea of similarity. For example, in the statement, Simho Devadatta. Devadatta is a lion. Right, so it's not like here, the other one you had the Ganga is there, but we're talking about the bank, which is connected to the Ganga, because you say the banks of the Ganges. Right? But here you're saying Devadatta is a lion. Right? So heroic Devadatta is metaphorically called a lion because of his lion-like qualities. Right? In contrast, the example of the general kind of lakshana, namely Gangayam Goshaha, involves a relationship, not of similarity, but of location.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Does that make sense? So there's some connection in the one, and in the other, it means it's more of a subtle. It's not a direct connection. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So lakshana is indirect in that it's a direct connection. It's not directly the thing. Right? Mukhya is directly the thing. Lakshana is a direct relationship. And then the gona means it's an indirect relationship.
So gona is speaking basically of the qualities of the...
Yeah. In this case, yes, of the qualities. Or a relationship. Does that make some sense? So it's just a little bit more subtle. Right? He's not a lion. He's not something connected to a lion. Right? But we're talking about the qualities, that bravery that is there in the lion. That is in Devadatta. Therefore, Devadatta is... Seems that Devadatta is the Sanskrit Jose. Or Joe. Well, actually, Joe and Jose, I think they're the same, right? Like that, because anytime they use an example, it's always David Dutta.
Right. Lakshana and Gona, they should be related to Mukhya, isn't it? So first we take.
Means they will be in the context of, let's say, other verses or the main verse, the Mukhya verse. But it may be in there, it may be that the whole verse is Lakshana. It's not that it has to be right there. It means like there's a set, like we see when we were studying Vedanta Sutra, that. There's a verse at the, there's a run of verses, let's say like 10 verses. And the one at the beginning and one at the end are pointing out things directly connected to the Lord and directly saying that. Then the verses in between, you know, they're talking about Indra or something, so it appears not. So then it's something, it's connected to, like that. So either it would be Lakshana in that, you're talking about Indra's qualities actually are coming from Krishna. So the Indra-ness of Indra is coming from Krishna. So therefore, you can call Krishna Indra. So when the demigod Indra says, you should worship Indra to understand the Supreme, he means you should worship Krishna. Like that. So it'd still be Lakshana, because even though it's qualities, because Krishna is directly connected there. Right, there is a relationship. Right, but in this other, it's not. There's not similar. You know how you say? Excuse me. Yeah, it's not of similarity, but of local. It means there's a connection there. While you're saying that, you know, he's the. How you say? He's the creator, like Brahma is the creator. Then he's not actually the creator. You know what I'm saying? But his creative potency comes from Krishna. So the point is it's all a lakshana of vritti. It's just that it has a little bit more indirect connection. You know, the poetics is extended more. Mm-hmm. Like that.
So in this way you can have the Mukhya Sutras, Gona Sutras, and
Means the sutras that will be giving the Mukhya point, and then there'll be ones in between that may also describe in a Mukhya way, or they may go into Lakshana. It doesn't matter. Point is that they're connected to the main sutras. Right?
So Lakshana and Gauna are supporting the Mukhya.
Lakshana and Gauna, yes. Yes. Okay.
Now, if we don't know if we go to the end of the Acharya, we can mix.
Yes, that's why we only do things in line with the Acharyas.
That's speculation.
Yes. See, one is that Prabhupada, when Prabhupada said he's written everything in the books, he literally means that. But now, because it's a matter also of understanding. So, the Prabhupada, in mentioning the things, it may be there's things that are obviously direct, but there's also things that may be more of a lakshana aspect, or it may be direct, but the words he's using we wouldn't use in that context, so we may not catch. And it doesn't matter, because if we're not catching, it's not for you, right? You know, it's like the sign on the back of the truck. It's there's this little dinky sign on the back of the truck. And the sign says, if you can read this, you're too close. Right? You know. So if you're farther back, you can't read. It doesn't matter because it's not for you. So when one's describing these things, then it's there. So in the acharyas, their definitions and that, because at times they use the technical points because of the Sanskrit and all that, then you might catch the technical things that Prabhupada's saying. Because Prabhupada will say very technical things in lay language. You know, using nice words and in a cultured way, but Prabhupada's books are accessible by the language.
Yes.
While you see the Acharya's works are not. Yes. You have to be a scholar to be able to. Like Jiva Goswami, it's not common reading. It means, and even when we say other Sampradayas read, only their scholars are reading. It's not that general devotees within the other Sampradayas are reading Jiva Goswami. It's only the scholars. So it's accessible there. So then when that is seen in context of what Srila Prabhupada is speaking, then you can see that connection and that authority, and that there's no contradiction in anything that the scriptures or the acharyas say. Does that make sense? Scripture to scripture, scripture to the acharyas, acharyas to acharyas. There's no contradiction anywhere. They're just bringing out various aspects and all that. So that's why then in the study we do these together. Like that. So we're studying Prabhupada's books with the support of the acharyas' works. It's not that we're studying Prabhupada's books and the acharyas. No, we're studying the Prabhupada's books with that support from the acharyas.
Mm-hmm.
Because without your acharya, you can't understand the previous acharyas anyway. And then by the grace of the previous acharyas, then we can understand more the technical details of what the Acharya says. So the principles we're getting from Prabhupada. With those principles, we look at the technical. Then from that, we can understand how Prabhupada's given that same technical. But if we don't do that, then we think, well, Prabhupada's saying this is the principle, someone else is saying something else is the principle, there's a difference here. That will never happen. It just does not happen.
So that this method, our appreciation for Prabhupada increases more.
I couldn't hear.
You study Prabhupada, then you study the acharyas, and from acharyas you come back to Prabhupada. So
yes.
Our appreciation for Prabhupada increases.
Yes. Yeah, by this method then the appreciation for Prabhupada increases. That's the whole point, is that it's based around this. That's the whole point. And you see it works very nicely. And you see, like Prabhupada says, the Vedanta Sutras means Bhagavatam is the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. We can see the Bhagavatam verses then say what the Vedanta Sutra says in a more full way, so that we can have more grasp, while the Sutra is very short. And then as we're going in through, we're reading in various parts of the Bhagavatam, and you see the point being made has already been made in the Vedanta Sutra. But now it's in a practical way applied in devotional practice by devotees.
Right?
So, like that, it's working. So that's then, these things are important so we catch the subtleties that are there. So it's not that Prabhupada doesn't use these. He uses all of this. But we may not catch the technicality of it, that we appreciate it from the others. So Sridhar Swami, he is the commentator on Srimad Bhagavatam, and all others are commenting following that mood of pure devotion. Right, so our commentary will bring out the achinta veda veda tattva aspect. Others will bring out other aspects. Does that make sense? Yeah. But we never approach the previous acharyas except through our acharya. So as Sridhar says this, Prabhupada says that. No, it means if you're saying that there's two different things, you shouldn't be reading the other acharya because you don't understand. Because it's not the words. Because the words have these three meanings. And unless you know what it is by your acharya, you will not know what the other acharya is saying. That's just the way it is. You know, it's like that sign on the bus. If you see a contradiction, you should not be reading. And if you don't see a contradiction, then it's all right to read. So whether you read or not, you're getting the essence anyway from Prabhupada's books. Right? Because if you only catch the externals from Prabhupada's books, then reading the acharyas, you'll also see the externals, then they'll seem to be different. But if you catch the principle that Prabhupada's talking about, the essence, then when you read the acharyas' works, then you'll see what they're talking about. Because they all are Sardagrahi devotees. They only talk the essence. And detail is given as connection to the essence. Right? In other words, pure devotion is the mukya, and then engaging the yukta vairagya, that's the lakshana. It only has meaning and connections to the direct. Is that, so it's always the same thing. So in grammar is being described because grammar is very set and everything will work there, and you generally always use your intelligence. While when we're applying these things, then we will tend to, our emotions will get involved. You know, our attachments, our desires, and that way we may misapply. You know, if you say, no, I'm applying properly, so you take it back to the grammar, which is set. Because when we talk grammar, no one's sitting there with all this emotion happening. It just doesn't happen like that. Right? You know what I'm saying? No, you ever hear someone coming back from their grammar class, you know, and not say, oh, it was such an emotional experience today. I really felt it today, you know? Yeah, no, it never happens. Right? So that's the whole point. When you discuss on the grammatical point, people will use their intelligence and put the emotions aside, then catching that. But it's always the same principles. So it's always primary and secondary. So mukhya is primary, lakshana is secondary. Right? In the first verse of the 87th chapter, Parikshit Maharaj expresses doubt as to how the words of the Vedas can refer to the absolute truth by any of the valid kinds of shabda vritti. He asks, Katam Sakshat Charanti, how can the Vedas directly describe Brahman by Rudha Mukhya Vritti? Literal meaning based on convention. Right? Because before we said was, you had, where was the Rudha and the, okay. But a primary meaning is called Rudha when it's based on conventional usage, and yoga when it's derived from another word's meaning by regular etymological rules. It means you connect it back through that. Yeah. You know, like sometimes you see is that by etymology you can explain something also. Yeah. Right? You say there's some person's using a word and said, do you know that that word means this? So you take it back to the Latin or the Greek or something. That actually means this. So, you know, what do you mean by this? Yeah. So you're using the direct, but it has these two forms, right? But we're keeping it as direct. Now, in indirect, in the lakshana, that it has these different, you know, has another form, gona, it doesn't matter, because it's indirect anyway. But if mukhya, you divide it as two different kinds, you know, like that, then give different names, people get confused, right? You know, the principal thing has to be that one thing, but it has two forms, rudhi and yoga. Right, so he's asking here that how can the Vedas directly describe Brahman by Rudha Mukhya Vritti? Right, by conventional usage, direct conventional usage. After all, the absolute truth is anirdesya, inaccessible to designation. And how can the Vedas even describe Brahman by Gona Vritti, metaphor based on similar qualities? Right, so he's just saying, how can they use any of these vrittis? Because Brahman is beyond that. So it's a very good question. Right? Does that make sense? And so like that.
By this particular, when they say that, how can the Vedas directly describe Brahman by Rudha Mukhya Vritti? So Brahman is Brahman cannot be described by Yoga Mukhya Vritti, right? Because Brahma is the source of all the other worlds. Is that also the reason?
There's a slight difficulty. I can't hear anything you say. In the winter, it's okay. But now you have competition. These two. And if you spoke Russian, then you'd have three. Yes.
When it mentions that the Vedas directly describe Brahman.
The Vedas dedicatedly describe Brahman.
Yeah,
here. It means when you sing, see, since I can barely hear you, no one else can hear you at all.
Yes.
So when you say something and then I say it,
yes,
that is so everybody else can hear. So you shouldn't take it, why is it, I haven't finished, why is he talking? You know, or, you know, this and that. Because I've also tried where you finish talking. Having finished talking, now I say it so everyone else can understand. And it's kind of like, well, why are you saying that? I already said that. What about the... So, Either way, it's a problem. But this one's easier because if I wait, I might forget, and so this way it's more complete. Is that what you said?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
It mentions about Brahman. Okay, speaking about Rudra Mukhya Vritti, can it, but it cannot belong to the category of Yoga Mukhya Vritti?
Means Brahman.
Yes.
But he's it means Parikshit Maharaj is mentioning it as Rudra Mukhya Vritti. So the point is Brahman, then also in the conventional usage, means Brahman. But the point is, but how can you define the Brahman by words? So it doesn't need the yoga one, because Brahman means Brahman. It doesn't have another meaning.
Okay. And who has defined the convention, the literal?
Who defines the conventional
Shastra
usage? That's what you have, as means the Shastra defines, and then based on that, then you have, that's why in the Vedas, then you have the Nirukta. Nirukta then defines the words.
Yes.
And that's based on the Veda. So therefore then, you know, I say in the Vedic, I think Yaska, he does the, you know, from Nirukta itself, the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have somebody else. We use Amar Kosh a lot.
Yeah, Amar Kosh is
like that. It's very, very standard. You know, because the Nirukta, it's actually Vedic Sanskrit. It's a dictionary in Vedic Sanskrit. And so if you understand Vedic Sanskrit, then it works very nicely for you. Then you can use it in both the Vedic and the conventional.
So it contains all the root words.
It has all the root words, but it because the point is for Vedic Sanskrit, Vedic grammar, then you need to know the grammar very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It means a modern dictionary, you can use it and you know zero grammar. That's how they made it. That's why they're so fat. If you understood grammar, they would just have to give the root word and its meaning, and you already know all these endings. You know, we don't have to put go, going, gone, you know, we don't have to do that. And so many words, there's so many declensions you can use. Then in the modern dictionary, you have to put all those. Well, in the Vedic dictionary or the Sanskrit, you only have to put one word, the root.
Mm-hmm.
And how that root comes out to be a practical use. And then you apply all the grammar to it. So therefore, you know, the actual grammatical dictionary would be, you know, 1/10 the size of anything else. Does that make sense? So his point is that how is it that Brahman, which is transcendental, can be described by words? That's the essence. But he's mentioned here Rudra Mukhya Vritti to make sure exactly you know, even the direct meanings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so let alone if it can't be described by Rudra Mukhya Vritti, mm-hmm. then how would it be by Yoga Mukra? How by Lakshana? Mm-hmm. How by Gona?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the point is if it can't be described by the direct, then, you know, it's not going to be.
Because however we find that all the prayers of the different devotees include this Gona Vritti, you know, that, you know, lotus feet, lotus eyes. So that this is the method is always involved in describing Brahman or the Supreme Person.
But it's also meaning that beauty. Yeah, so then, yeah. But the so then what's the question?
Well, the question is that this is that it's a bona fide way of even though the Lord doesn't have any designation, but this is a method being used to approach Him and glorify Him.
Can we glorify the Lord through Rudra Mukhya Vritti? Is that the question?
No, Gauna Vritti is what is being used.
But why are you asking that?
Because it mentions Gauna Vritti as a metaphor based on similar
concepts. But didn't you catch what it is? How can the Vedas directly describe Brahman by Rudra Mukhya Vritti, which is the most direct of the direct? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Literal meaning, divestment, convention. After all, the Absolute is Anirdesya, means inaccessible to designation.
Mm-hmm.
And how can the Vedas even describe Brahman by Gauna Vritti, a metaphor based on similar qualities? So then if it's correct, why are you asking the question?
That instead of the Rudra Mukhya Vritti, the devotees are using Gauna Vritti. That is my question. Why do they use Gauna Vritti instead of Rudra Mukhya Vritti or glorifying the Lord?
So the question is, why are they using the Gona Vritti to offer prayers to the Lord instead of the Rudha Mukhya Vritti?
Because it is more direct.
Because it's more direct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. It means where we started 5 minutes ago, I would have not known that was the question. I mean, nowhere near. Sorry. But is that the topic we're discussing now? What is the topic that Sridhar Swami is bringing out here? See, in other words, you're taking the words Rudha Mukhya Vritti, Gona Vritti, and Vedas describing, and then taking that into the prayers, and then going off in that direction. But is that the topic? What is actually the point being discussed?
The Mukhya Vritti is discussed.
No. What's the actual point being discussed?
That the Lord is inconceivable and how the words are able to describe that.
Yes.
Inconceivable Lord.
So then why, if it can't be in Mukhya, why would you ask about the Gona Lakshana? It's just like, it's just like if you're saying the 100 rupees includes the 10, you only have to mention the 100. So the others are in quiet. So then why would you say, he's asking, okay, why are they spending 100,000? Got it? Okay, thank you.
For similarity, like in Gona Vritti, you compare between two similar objects. So, in order to find similarities, first of all, you should be able to express that it is something.
Yes.
Brahman is something, then only you can compare it to something else.
Yes.
First of all, you are not able. The point is, we cannot even define Brahman, then how can you compare?
Because point is, if in direct you can't do it, why would you do it indirect? Because you have to have a definition. So that's the whole point, is that this whole discussion comes up, is that how do you compare the words? But now in that, because we're dealing with the technical philosophical aspects, they have to bring it down to exactly what they're meaning. Because otherwise someone would say, okay, in that it doesn't, but then in this it does. You know, so you have to point it out so it's very clear. It's like you see in the Vedanta Sutra, we go through the points to such degree that there aren't any avenues left to disagree with the point. Right? A principle is being given by the scriptures. Someone has a doubt. So then based on that, then they come up with so many angles to approach it. So then the ideas of philosophy removes all doubts, means all those angles. So that technical aspect is there. Right? So then, yeah. So that's why it's being presented and discussed on this technical level, so that no one makes that mistake. Because if you establish this, you've established Shastra, then you can establish everything else. So it's a very important point. That's why it's the first verse of the chapter, and you know, already so many pages of, you know, purports and stuff like that. The Vedas are guna vrittayaha, full of qualitative descriptions, but Brahman is nirguna, without qualities. Obviously, a metaphor based on similar qualities cannot apply in the case of something that has no qualities. Right? So Brahman has no qualities, how can you use anything to describe? Furthermore, Pringham Maharaj points out that Brahman is sat-asat-param, beyond all causes and effects, having no connection with any manifest existence, subtle or gross. The absolute cannot be expressed by either yoga vritti, a meaning derived etymologically, or lakshana, metaphor, since both require some relationship of Brahman to other entities. Right? Well, thus, Pariksit Maharaj is puzzled as to how the words of the Vedas can directly describe the absolute truth. Right? So, since you can't compare Brahman to anything, how can you even describe it? Because all descriptions, either there has to be a direct description, or there has to be a comparison to something. And so if you can't describe, how can you get either? So, that's his question. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, King Parikit inquired from Sukadeva Goswami about a very important topic in understanding transcendental subject matter. His question was, since Vedic knowledge generally deals with the subject matter of the three qualities of the material world, how then can it approach the subject matter of transcendence, which is beyond the approach of the three material modes? Since the mind is material and the vibration of words is a material sound, how can the Vedic knowledge expressed by material sound, the thoughts of the material mind, approach transcendence? Right? That's why we read Prabhupada's books. So all that what was discussed before is very nicely said here. Right? Yeah, that's the whole point that we were saying, that one Sri Vaishnava scholar, he mentioned that, I don't remember the verse, but it's a major verse, where Ramanujacharya, it was so important, he wrote a 26-page commentary. He said, Prabhupada says exactly the same thing in half a page. Like that. So, that's the point. That's why we see them both. Because, one, now, by dealing with that, then we get into all the technical, then we read this, we see it's already in Prabhupada's book. But now if you know these technical points of grammar and language, you can understand all those things that Prabhupada meant. He didn't miss out on any of that. You just have to know the language. So in other words, as you mature in your understanding, then you'll have deeper and deeper understandings of the application, you know, the Abhideya. So that means your understanding of these definitions gets deeper and deeper, so you can see it in a variety of ways. Right? That's also then why you discuss it from different angles, because the different angles means externally it appears to be contradictory. But they're not, because there's a common principle. So you're trying to discuss it from different angles to get to the principle. Right? If one person says this, someone else says that, then that means there's something common that holds those together. Right? You know, so if you say, okay, we have black, we have white, but then if we understand color, there's no contradiction. In fact, you can accommodate other colors also. Right? So once you know the principle, that's the key to understanding how everything works. That's why it says, if you know Krishna, you know everything. The purpose of King Parikit's inquiry was to ascertain from Sukadeva Goswami whether the Vedas ultimately describe the absolute truth as impersonal or as personal. Right? Because all this has been, we're end of 10th canto, so all these pastimes of the Lord are there. So, the whole point is the ultimate position of the Lord, is it personal or impersonal? Right? Why would that come up? Because we've been describing the Lord's pastimes with words. And the point is if you can't describe Brahman with words and all that, so what are we describing? Does that mean these pastimes are on a lower level? So is this then a manifestation of, you know, the highest form of goodness, you know, as some scholars will say? But Brahman is beyond that, so that's why it's not described. So if that comes up, then it makes impersonalism the highest platform. And so that's going to be a problem for devotees, because Bhagavan is the highest platform. And so, therefore, he wants to bring out this point that, yes, you can describe the Supreme Lord, the person, with words. Because it's already been described, the person is the highest. You understand? Understanding of the absolute truth progresses in three features: impersonal, Brahman, Paramatma, localized in everyone's heart, and at last, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. The Vedas deal with three departments of activities. One is called Karmakanda, or activities under Vedic injunction, which gradually purify one to understand his real position. Right? The whole point of the Karmakanda is to get purified to understand that we're the sole servant of Krishna. That's its point. That's why, that's its purpose, right? So that's why the devotees maybe are using aspects that one might call karma. But the purpose of karma is to purify yourself to understand you're the soul, then to be engaged in Krishna service. So those aspects that are directly applicable in using for service to the Lord, then those things are used. and other areas, then not so much. Right? Things that are meant for keeping you in the world or for those attached to the world that want to stay here, those parts you don't require. But the actual purpose is to, in other words, the whole purpose of karma kanda is to get you to the point of using the activities we would call karma yoga and drop all the rest of it. But until they get to that point of purity to have that, and then in the association with Vaishnavas, then they can take it up. So we see those purified by karma, just like, let's say, for example, you have a typical follower of the Vedas. They follow that, so they're purified, right? Now let's say the devotees are coming to town, there's a preaching program and all this and that. Now, would that person be inclined to invite them to their house?
Yes.
Why? Because that from the Shastra, what it says, that it's very beneficial for you in piety to invite saintly people to your house. Right? It's not making a distinction between what kind of saintly people. It just says saintly people. It doesn't just say, you know, hardcore, you know, Mayavadis. It just says the saintly people. So, therefore, then they'll invite to the house and there'll be a program. They'll have their family there. They'll invite some friends, relatives. Right? You know, then they'll hear this subject matter. So they've been purified by following the Vedas. So now in that pure state, hearing the actual conclusion of the Vedas, then you'll see they'll progress towards devotional service. Right? So some very quickly become devotees, and some just remain pious people who, and those who are very attached to their materialistic position and don't appreciate the idea of moving on to transcendence, then they may avoid the devotees after that. You know, they'll respect because they're sadhus, but they won't invite them to the house again. Right? Does that make sense? So that's because of following the Vedic culture and following this karma kanda. Now, let's say you go to any other major city of the world. Are people coming out and inviting us? No. Yeah. So, because they're not following these aspects of karma kanda, so they're not purifying themselves, so they can't appreciate. But the point is one doesn't have to start there. One start means, if you're not, it means wherever you are, you start following karma yoga. Right? In other words, if you've been following karma kanda, so then you are purified. Then coming in contact with the devotees, you take up karma yoga. Now, you know, it means karma in connection with Krishna's bhakti. If you're not, you've been following all, you know, how you say, the karmic activities. You come in contact with the devotees, you're convinced the devotional service, you take up karma yoga. You don't have to go back and perform all the different things. You know, sometimes those who are, you know, attached to the rules and regulations, they'll say you have to do that. Right, you know, first come, take birth in India, then you can do all these things and all that kind of jazz. Yeah. Is that, yeah. So it's not necessary. We don't have to go through these things. Prabhupada's already given us the essence and it's already there. Okay, so it means karmakanda. Okay, one is called karmakanda, activities under Vedic injunction, which gradually purify one to understand his real position. That's its purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Krishna made the material world to bring the living entity back to Godhead. So that means the Veda is the process for doing that, but it's accommodating for all the variety of living entities. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The next is Jnanakanda, the process of understanding the absolute truth by speculative methods. So someone who likes to speculate, and they're cultivated in that, now they come across Krishna consciousness, now they use Jnana Yoga. Does that make sense? The process of, you know, this Jnana Marga or Jnanakanda, that we're not interested in. We're only interested in Jnana Yoga. Right? And the third is Upasanakanda, or worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and sometimes of the demigods also. Right? So, just as karmakanda is to get you to understand who you are as the soul, the jnanakanda is to understand the absolute truth and your relationship there. And so the upasanakanda is for worshiping the Lord. Right? So, but people will use it for worshiping the demigods, they'll use the impersonal for just not understanding, you know, the Supreme Person. Like that, and they'll use karmakanda for their own sense gratification. not for purifying themselves to understand they're the soul. Right? Servant of Krishna. So, these sections are there, but people don't follow them properly. So, that they'll still follow the Veda. In other words, as we've shown, someone who follows the Veda is more inclined towards devotional activities than someone who's not. Right? Like that. You know, so you don't say, someone goes, oh, we're Indians, we don't follow all this devotional stuff. Right? But people say, oh, we're Westerners, we don't follow all this devotional stuff. Right? That's the difference. Okay? So, therefore, it's already been established that someone who follows the Vedas is going to be better situated than someone who doesn't. He'll have more knowledge, heart will be purified, he'll be living a lifestyle that is much more conducive for Krishna conscious. Because means they're in the morning they get up and they do their puja, right? These followers of the Vedas. What do you have to change here? Just who they're worshipping, right? You have to take all those, you know, 50 pictures and all that, and put Krishna and a few other, you know, like that, right? Does that make sense?
Keep the frames.
Yeah.
There is an advertisement. Who the Buddha is coming? I don't worship the idol. I spend time with my family. This is a new advertisement.
The new. Oh, okay. So they're Durga Puja is time for the family.
No, just family.
Yeah, just family. And then by family, that means Durga Puja is like their Christmas, so that means you have to get gifts, so that means you go out shopping, so that means therefore. Yeah. Okay, so, you understand? So that they're followers of the Vedas, then that's better. Now, will they follow if there's only pure devotion is the only thing being described? No, that means there'd be a handful of devotees in the universe and everybody else would be demons. You know, not following the Vedas, the place would be totally insane. So would the devotees be able to practice things? No. Yeah. So, therefore then, the Vedas give, within the context of that area, then ways they can distract themselves and keep themselves busy in the areas of karma, jnana, and upasana khandas. But they'll still follow the Veda. Right? So now coming in contact with devotees, then they give up those aspects that are unimportant, and the ones that are standard, those are kept. In other words, the Vaishnava lifestyle is defined in the Vedas, and then it gives some extra stuff in case you're not so interested in just using it just for Krishna. Right? But the whole point is that it will purify you if you follow it properly. Just the devotional service will do it in one lifetime, and the others will take thousands and millions. And unless you bump into a devotee, it'll just keep going around and around. Right? What is it? That's the saying. Around and around and around she goes. Where it stops, nobody knows. So that's the, how you say, the material, the aphorism of samsara. Right? Yes. The worship of the demigods recommended in the Vedas is ordered with the understanding of the demigods' relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead as defined in the Veda, in the Upanishads, right? We saw Indra is even saying, worship Indra means you worship Krishna, because he's the Indra, not the demigod. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has many parts and parcels. Some are called svamsas, or his personal expansions, and some are called vibhinamsas, the living entities. All such expansions, both svamsas and vibhinamsas, are emanations from the original personality of Godhead. Svamsa expansions are called Vishnu-tattva, whereas the vibhinamsa expansions are called Jiva-tattva. The different demigods are Jiva-tattva. The conditioned souls are generally put into the activities of the material world for sense gratification. Therefore, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, to regulate those who are very much addicted to different kinds of sense gratification, the worship of demigods is sometimes recommended. Right? Means you would recommend worship of the Lord, but if they're two, then it may be recommended because they're just not interested, they're not going to do. They're not going to, you know, they are only going to focus on the other anyway. Right? It's just like you have the opportunity to do some service, and you have the opportunity to, you know, maintain your, you know, family scene and everything like that. So we see is that a lot of people, the maintenance of the family and that environment is so great that there's hardly any devotional activity. You know, they'll listen to, you know, put some music on, some, you know, music now and again, or maybe a lecture on a really, you know, really emotional day or something. And the temple, yeah, they'll make that endeavor to go on Janmashtami, because if you go for another day, you go for Mangalarti, you have to get up really early, then you go to Mangalarti, and then after Mangalarti, you just go home. And now what? You're tired and this and that. You have to eat breakfast, go to work, this, that, blah. Janmashtami, at least it's a full day of a thing, it's a big thing, and at least it's the biggest of all the festivals, so if you're going to go for one of them, you're going to go for that one. Right? Plus, it's so late at night, and you don't have to cook, because there'll always be a feast. So, yeah, Mangalarti, you still have to go back and cook. Right? So then, you'll go for that. But, the identity will be as a devotee. Right? Though the majority of the time and consciousness and everything is on karma. Right? But they're devotees. They identify that way. What about people who are on that same interest in karma but don't identify as devotees? Then you have to expand that area of karma more for them so that they feel they're engaged and they have faith in the Veda. You understand? So then when one takes up devotional service, you reduce it down to what's just required in devotional service. The extensions are only for those who are going to do all nonsense anyway, so at least they should do the nonsense as is given that works with the laws of nature. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, okay, let us say, okay, someone's going to drive the car, right? And so the purpose of the car is to get from one point to another to, you know, do things in connection with your devotional life. Right? And so then there's standard activities that you do with that car. Right? Now, then you have someone else, right? How you say? In this case, identified as a teenager. Okay? So they have other interests in using this car to go to work or go to the temple or go to the, you know, store to buy, you know, groceries. They just want to go out for some fun, right? Known as a joyride, right? And so then they're not going to just follow the regular rules. They want, you know, they want to go fast, and this and that. So therefore, then there's rules that govern going fast. Does that make sense? Just like for a normal person, if they're driving down the road doing normally, probably most people don't know that, let's say you're going around the corner and you go too fast. Right? So oversteers. So the front starts going in the direction you want, but the back doesn't. The back keeps going the direction it was going, though the front goes the way you want. So that's called, I think, oversteer. Right? Means that. So the back starts sliding. Now most people, because the back's sliding and they want to go the direction they want and it's going the wrong way, will keep turning in the way that they've been going. And so then the car will spin. Right? Now, the actual thing is that you turn into the spin. So if the back starts spinning to the left, you turn the car, the front wheels to the left. So that makes the car go straight. So for the regular things, if you know that, it's good to know. In fact, they probably will tell you this when you're doing your driver's ed or driver exam. But most people will never have to use it in their life, because they are not in situations where that would be. It's for emergencies. Maybe on the ice it does, or something happens. You know, just by chance. But now, if we're dealing with these kids that want to go out and have that, for them, this is extremely essential knowledge. They actually can't function without this. And especially if they're into drifting, then they really have to know this. You understand? So, that's the meaning of the karmakanda. It's not necessary, but it's there so that you don't kill yourself in following karma. Right? So that you deal with the car according to the modes of nature, you know, that in these applications that you don't require, you're not going to run in trouble because you're following the laws of nature. So in other words, the standard usage, there's only certain aspects of the laws of nature you have to look at, because that's all you require to use. Since the idea is to go back to Godhead, you only use how much you need here. You don't use more. But those who are interested in the material world, they want to use areas outside of what's necessary in devotional service. So then there's laws governing that so that it's successful. And if you don't follow the laws, you will crash and burn. That's just the way it is. Does that make sense? So that's what karmakanda, jnanakanda, upasana do. They regulate your lifestyle. So even though you have all these material desires in karma and jnana and in worship, you won't kill yourself. You won't destroy yourself. You'll still be viable for following the Vedic culture in devotional service. And so you can see is that naturally then those aspects of karma that are not necessary, the devotee gives up. Like, he doesn't have to worship the forefathers and this and that. He doesn't have to do all those things. That's what's meant. It's not meant, oh, we don't have to follow any rules. No, that's called malecha yavana. You understand? It means when Prabhupada says we give up the rules, it means we give up all these rules. As you mentioned, Manu, out of 12 chapters, one chapter is dedicated only to how you worship the forefathers. One full chapter. Right? For describing vanaprastha and sannyas, he does both of them in one chapter. Right? And describing other rules compared to grihastha ashram, it takes two chapters. So that means out of three chapters on grihastha life, right? Sorry? Or is that even a fourth? No, yeah, it's just within it. So one third of the information given is just on worshiping the forefathers, which basically you do once a year. And two chapters is what you do every day and this and that and everything like that. Does that make sense? How much rules are here? So by chanting Hare Krishna, you don't have to do that one. Does that mean the other two chapters you don't do? You can't say that. Oh, we don't give up this, we give up all rules. So, therefore, the original culture, then that is given in its essence in the Veda. But for those who aren't satisfied with that because they have to go beyond that because of their material desire, then the Veda expands on that, how the modes of nature can be used within the same context, the same principle, that as you take up devotional service, you start dropping all these things. So now, let us say that teenager now, having been out and been crazy and all that, you know, has not killed themselves because of knowing all these things, then when they get older, then they don't do that stuff anymore. But now they know if there ever is a slight, they can deal with it very naturally. So they may never have to use it, but it's there. You know what I'm saying? And for others, then if they know it or not, they're not going to bump into it anyway, so it doesn't matter. Does that make sense? So that's the whole thing, is that So all these different things are there just to come down on that. So it's for, you give up the sense gratification, it's just you're doing things to please Krishna, therefore it has that devotional. So we don't call it karma kanda anymore, because it's not. It's not the path of karma, it's the path of yoga. But you're engaging karma, so it's called karma yoga. Right? And so you're connecting to the Supreme. Now, When that's on the platform of pure devotion, it's called bhakti yoga. But it still has karma in it. You still do activities in devotion, you still use your intelligence, you still engage the mind. But you don't have to call it. Or you can call it karma yoga, means engaging your activities in Krishna service. So here, karma yoga means pure devotion. Right? So it has all those different aspects of the, that's the thing about the Vedic, is it all naturally is homogenous. It goes together very nicely. It's seamless. Moving from one position to another, it doesn't require a change. That's what Prabhupada says, you don't have to change anything. You just change the consciousness. Then, naturally, whatever needs to be adjusted, you do. You're doing that anyway. You know? You decide you're going to the kitchen in the morning, you decide you're going to have your cereal, you know, you get the cereal out, you get your bowl out, you go to the refrigerator, there isn't any milk. So now you're going to eat your cereal? No, you're going to look for something else. Does that make sense? So you're always making adjustments anyway, based on the principle. You're going to eat. So when you change the consciousness to devotion to Krishna, you don't have to change the external, because you'll do it automatically as it's useful in Krishna's service. So therefore, since I've changed the consciousness, I only do things for Krishna, then this activity that I've been doing my whole life is useful for Krishna, I will do it. And if it's not useful for Krishna, I won't do it. It's that simple. That's why you don't have to make a separate endeavor. But it has to be understood in its proper light. Otherwise, then we increase the mundane, and the very point that Pariksit Maharaj is worried about then happens. We identify according to the mundane. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaurav Vrindavan ki.